I was muted.
It's all good. It's all good.
All good. Awesome. Well, that's why editing's there.
There you go. There you go.
So today I am here with Jean-Philippe, Chief Public Health Officer for HSR.health.com, or just HSR. And so that's their website. Yeah. And so also I'm excited to be able to talk to someone that has chief before the title. That's pretty cool. But how are you doing today, Jean?
I'm doing good, Jasmine. Thank you for having me here on your program.
Yeah, no problem.
Podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background? You said you're from Brazil.
Yeah, definitely. Well, before I start, of course, let me just dot some I's and cross some T's. I work for Health Solutions Research. The acronym is HSR. The dot health is from our website. And I guess I want to make sure that I say from the beginning that everything I'm going to talk to you about is just my personal views, my personal experience, and my personal opinion. Nothing that I'm saying here reflects any kind of official policy or official position from my company, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about myself too, or your original question. So my name is Jean-Philippe. I'm originally from Brazil. I came to the United States when I was 12 years old, and I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia, in the heart of the Appalachian region. So I'm an Appalachian boy. I grew up in Roanoke, a small city of about 93,000 people, close to Virginia Tech. That might be a more familiar place for a lot of people. I went to middle school, high school, and college there, Roanoke College, class of 2005. I worked for a couple of years, and then I went to the VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine in Richmond, Virginia. I got my medical degree. Then I went to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, at Wake Forest Baptist Health System, where I trained in internal medicine for 3 years, and I was also a primary care provider for about 130 to 140 patients during that time. After my training, I went to work. I came back to Richmond, and I went to work as a medical officer in the Collaborative Improvement Division of the United Network for Organ Sharing, also known as UNOS. For those that don't know, UNOS, they oversee organ transplantation in the United States. So I was part of their Collaborative Improvement Division, and the goal of that division was just to do performance improvement with hospitals. So I spearheaded collaborative improvement projects between hospitals where we would bring hospitals together around a particular problem and just brainstorm for a period of 6 to 9 months at a time for multiple issues. And some of those collaborative improvement projects sometimes ran from 12 hospitals to 58 hospitals. So I did that for 5 years. My true passion, though, was has always been public health. I love public health and population health, so I knew that that was what I was wanted to go into. While I was at UNOS, I got a master's degree in public health from the University of Maryland School of Public Health. And I finally came to, I became what I wanted to be, a public health professional, which brought me to, through the University of Maryland, brought me to the Health Solutions Research, first as an intern, and then as their chief public health officer.
Very well said.
Anything else about me?
Well, yeah, I know, like, what else is there? So, I do want to talk a little bit about, so you said you came from Brazil at the age of 12. Was there a transitionary period, like in terms of culture?
A little bit. You know, there wasn't too much of a culture clash, you know, from Latin American culture, because the United States is almost a Latin American country itself, right? There's tens of millions of Latinos and Hispanic people in the United States. So it wasn't a huge shock, you know, and the cultural differences were minimal. So and it probably helped that I was 12. When you're a child, it's a lot easier to adapt, right?
Yeah.
So for me, I remember that time actually as being very magical, because you have to understand, when you don't live in the United States is kind of a wonderland, right? Mm-hmm. Because all the movies I watched, all the comic books I read, all the TV shows I watched, they took place in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
New York City, Washington, California, Texas. I knew all those places from pop culture, from watching movies, from reading comics. You know, I knew that Peter Parker, Spider-Man, was in New York City, and now I was going to live in the same country as Spider-Man. Like, so that was a big deal for me when I was 12. So I remember it being a very magical time for me of being in this like wonderland that was the United States. So I think that also helped with the cultural shift, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you just mentioned my favorite superhero. So Spider-Man. Yeah. I remember watching him my first time, like at the drive-in, and I've always had Spider-Man action figures. Well, I grew up on action figures, and I dressed up as Spider-Man for many years. And I recently went to a Comic-Con here in Phoenix and to have a picture with me with Spider-Man. So yeah, definitely my favorite superhero of all time. Now,
I respect that. I love it.
Yeah. And then another question is, just out of curiosity, how was it being a primary care physician for like over 130 people?
It was both very rewarding and heartwarming and very stressful and soul crushing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the reality of medicine in the United States, right? It was rewarding because I was making such a big impact on people's lives, right? I was helping people. I was relieving pain. I was relieving discomfort. I was getting to the bottom of medical problems. You know, I was taking care of people, which anybody that goes into medicine, that's the core thing you want to do, right? Is to help people. So as a primary care provider, that's what I did, you know, all the time. And it was also, you know, so it was like, it was very humbling to be, I was very young. Yeah. I don't want to say the life of 130 people in my hands, but it kind of was, right? In a touch of a button, I could do things that would affect them for years afterwards. So sometimes it was a lot of responsibility as well. And there were some patients, right, that they just glob onto you. You're like the source mm-hmm. of all truth, right? And they wouldn't do anything before talking to you first, you know? So sometimes it was embarrassing because I would have very experienced doctors, right? Doctors have been doing this for 30 years. They would call me and they say, hey, can you talk to Mrs. X about this mm-hmm. procedure that she needs to have? She won't say yes unless you say yes. And I was embarrassed because I'm like a baby doctor. I've only had, you know, I just graduated a year ago. And this very respected physician is kind of has to call me. And I have to be like, yes, I'll talk to her. We'll do it. You know, so it was that kind of humbling thing that all these people were very dependent on me, dependent on they wouldn't make decisions without me. So that was very heartwarming to be part of, to be taking care of all these people. But it was also very sad and depressing sometimes because I just did not have enough resources to take care of all them like I wanted to, right?
Mm-hmm.
On a typical day, I would see them for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you, and it's just impossible to get to the bottom, to have a satisfactory medical visit in 30 minutes is just impossible. And that is one of the problems that American healthcare faces today is this kind of like assembly line, right? Because they would come in, they had 30 minutes. I could not extend that time because I already had two other people after them waiting in the rooms, right? So it has to be very tight. And a lot of them were very, very sick with a lot of chronic issues. And the way it works, whenever somebody comes to see you, you have to not only address whatever they're feeling right now, what we call the acute problems, but you mm-hmm. also have to address their chronic problems, right? If they have diabetes, for example, you have to check the progress of their diabetes. You have to look at their sugars. You have to see how well controlled they are. You have to talk about any side effects since you last saw them. You have to do sensory checks, right? Because diabetes causes nerve damage. So you have to do foot checks. You have to do vibration tests. It's a very involved thing that takes 15 to 20 minutes. If they have high blood pressure, you have to make sure their blood pressure is well controlled. If it's not, you have to talk to them about it. Have you been taking your medication? Blah, blah, blah. So as you can see, the more chronic problems they have, the more time I have to spend making sure that those problems are controlled. So if mm-hmm. they have any acute problems, you know, like they sometimes there's no time to go through those. And it sucked because a lot of times I would have to ask them literally that to choose what they wanted to talk about. I'd be like, what do you want to talk about? And they're like, well, I've been having chest pain. My back pain is really bad. And I pooped blood last week. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, each one of those is 30 minutes. I don't have enough time. So I'm like, I need you to pick. And sometimes they would pick the one that, you know, they'd be like, well, I want to talk about my back pain. And I'd be like, actually, we need to talk about that bloody poop. You know, like, yeah. So it was like sad, you know, like that. And I was very unsatisfied every day because I felt like I was not able to do what I wanted. They were not able to get what they wanted. And it was constant without stopping, you know, 12 patients a day. And so those issues kind of like, it leads to burnout because mm-hmm. you feel like you're, it's a very Sisyphean task. Do you know what Sisyphus was?
No.
in Greek mythology, he was a person who was condemned to an afterlife of punishment. He had to constantly roll a big rock up a
hill. So I've heard of the story. I just didn't know the guy. Okay, so I've heard the story. Yeah.
So you know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of become like a byword for futile tasks. So in many ways, it felt futile. It felt like I was not healing them. I was not curing them. I was just band-aiding them, you know, bandaging them. So it was equal parts rewarding and equal parts depressing.
Do you think that's a common theme with a lot of people in medicine, burnout?
Absolutely, 100%. If you look at surveys of opinions, the majority of physicians regret going into medicine. The majority of physicians don't feel happy about their job. The majority of physicians don't think they make a difference. For many, many years, being a physician was I think still might be true, some of the highest rates of suicides among professional careers in the United States. Very high rates of depression, very high rates of drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And I think much of it stems from that, from the fact that it never ends. It's just like this torrent of patience. You know, there's never any time to rest and there's no sense of accomplishment at the end. So it's very common, yes, sadly.
So now, because, I mean, you've worked for UNOS, United Network for Network Sharing. Also, you've experienced with the CDC, especially during the pandemic. And then now you're with HSR. With all of your experience in multiple organizations like that, how do you now see GIS being able to be a beneficial tool for epidemiology and health crises?
Well, it's a very important tool, right? So the thing about GIS is that, and that was the thing that attracted me when my boss asked me if I wanted to join the company and lead the public health team. Because I'll be honest with you, I had never encountered GIS as a discipline. You know, I've always looked at maps. I've always loved maps. And I've always seen maps in the context of my studies, right? Everyone has seen disease prevalence and disease incidence maps. Are you familiar with those terms?
Yes.
So everyone has seen those maps before. But I never thought about the fact that this is a discipline in itself. And this creates tools that can help health decision makers make better decisions regarding health, both population health in clinical medicine. So when I came to HSR as an intern, that was like my first time seeing this in action, you know? And I was like, man, this is a powerful tool, you know? And it kind of opened up this kaleidoscope of different industries in healthcare and public health. And I was like, man, this is very interesting. So when he asked me to join, I joined primarily because of that, because I felt like this is a way to do what I want to do, which is global health. But this is a tool that's very actionable. This is something that can be used. I know I personally am very big on field, something that works in the field. A lot of people are very theoretical. I like theory, but I don't think it's important. I think more important is, will this help someone? Can this be used in the field? Can an epidemiologist in Uganda use our GIS tools to do their job in a better way and save more lives? So that was kind of the promise. You know, I thought, my personal opinion, there was like, yes, it can. That's why I agreed to come and join the team, right? And I haven't been proven wrong yet. I've been proven more and more right, because our tools are very, very useful for a variety of ways, right? In a variety of ways. And so that's what what I'm most proud of our work is, that it's not just some theoretical highfalutin, you know, thing in an ivory tower. It's an actual tool that can help save lives.
Yeah. And it's like you said, that I think a lot of times, not even just in this industry, but in other industries, you have an idea and it's really big and grandiose, but the practicality isn't there.
That's right. Yeah. So I like that. So for example, you know, like when I came in as an intern, what we were working on, we had just been the World Health Organization had just brought us in to help them create COVID-19 risk maps for sub-Saharan African countries. If you remember, in the fall of 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic was raging in full. And there was a lot of fear of what would happen when it hit Africa, right? Mm-hmm. Because it had come out of China in December 2019 and hit most Asian countries in the spring, in the United States by April or May, and Europe in that summer too. And it had collapsed health system, right? If you remember, Northern Italy's health system completely collapsed. New York City was about to collapse. So people were like, in wealthy countries, look at what this disease is doing. What's going to happen when it hits a poor country, a resource poor country, like in Africa? So the World Health Organization, to their credit, which, you know, I don't know if you know much about the World Health Organization, but they're famous for being very slow moving, very bureaucratic. You know, they're always the last people to show up. Kind of, that's the joke, you know, in the public health field. But in a rare moment, I guess, of a proactiveness, they said, let's help African countries plan for this, you know, before the disease hits them really hard. So that's what we were engaged to do. They asked us, can you use GIS to create something that helps them prepare? So we said, yes, we can. So what we did is we were, for 16 sub-Saharan countries, we created maps for each one of them that delineated transmission risk, hospitalization risk, and mortality risk. Basically telling them, when COVID hits your country, these are the areas that are going to have X risk. So for transmission risk, for example, you know, if a country has, I don't know, seven provinces, we would calculate using a variety of factors, right? We looked at multiple things. We looked at age cohort, right? Because as you know, the older you are, the higher your risk of getting severe disease from COVID, right? We looked at things like healthcare resources, distribution of hospitals. We looked at a population density. We looked at movement of people, right? Because for transmission, the more dense a place is, the higher the population density, the higher the risk of transmission. Likewise, the lower the density, the lower the rate of transmission. So if you want to compare two different provinces side by side, the province that has the higher population density, by almost by definition, will have a higher transmission risk. Now, they may not have the higher hospitalization risk because there's a different set of factors that affect hospitalization. In fact, the other province might have a higher hospitalization risk. And neither of them might have a high mortality risk because it's yet a third set of factors that cause that influence mortality, whether or not you die if you get COVID. Mm-hmm. So that's why we wanted to do three maps for every country, right? So we would do this. So for every country, we would delineate exactly, okay, when COVID hits, these are the regions where transmission will be the highest because of these 37 factors that we've mapped out, that we've calculated. These are the places where hospitalization risk is going to be the highest because of these 24 factors that we mapped out. And these are the places where mortality is going to be the highest, where more people are going to die because of these 11 factors that we've mapped out. Plan accordingly. So that was the hope, was once they had this, they could be like, okay, we can prepare now, you know, because that's one of the things that GIS is very powerful for, right? There are two core, there's one core thing that I would say that GIS in public health provides. Is number one, it identifies vulnerable populations. It shows you where are the people most likely to die, to suffer, so that you as a health decision maker or a policy decision maker can make strategic decisions for resource allocation. Because you are never going to have enough money to treat everyone in a country or a state, right? Let's say Virginia. Virginia has 36 health districts, right? If COVID-19 hits Virginia and there's a desperate need for vaccines, we have to vaccinate as many people as possible. The public health authorities of Virginia are going to be like, do we have enough money to vaccinate all 36 counties, all 36 health districts? And their budget person will invariably say, goodness, no, we have enough money to vaccinate 10. So that public health decision maker has to make a decision. Where do I deploy my scarce resources? And that's where GIS was very, very useful because we can identify in Virginia, for example, we did this, by the way, in Maryland. We can identify where the risk of transmission, mortality, and hospitalization will be the highest so that in those 10 places, we can identify the top 10 places that you can put your resources in. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's what we were trying to do for Africa, right? It was like we were trying to give them time to prepare, to have this strategic allocation of their very scarce resources. So that's one of the things that I think is very powerful about GIS. And that's my vision for the future with GIS is that we can, because there's a lot of public health challenges in the world today, right? COVID-19 is just one of them. You also have neglected tropical diseases that trap hundreds of millions of people, particularly in the global south, into the cycle of poverty. You have HIV/AIDS, which has not gone away, you know, even though it's a manageable disease in the United States, it's still very much a death sentence in many other countries, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. You have tuberculosis, which is the deadliest infectious disease in the planet. You have malaria, which still kills 400,000 or 500,000 people every year. So you have a lot of public health challenges still. And they're particularly acute in the places that have the least amount of resources to tackle them. So how do you help them? And that's how GIS can really help them, because we can tell them, look, you don't have enough money to vaccinate every child in all 15 of your provinces. But the top five, where the risk is the greatest, we can identify that for you so that you can put those resources where the return of investment will be the greatest, where you will save the most lives. So that's what I hope that we are doing and we will continue to do.
Is that through Geo AI?
Sir,
are you using Geo AI to get these calculations?
We do. We use artificial intelligence and machine learning in many of our calculations. You know, one of the big things that we use artificial learning and artificial intelligence and machine learning for is one, to find patterns where we can't, right? That is one of the greatest promises of machine learning, is that you and I, you probably know this, right? Human beings are, a lot of times we're not very good at finding patterns, right? Because one, we find patterns where there are none. And that's just a nature of human beings, right? If you stare at a cloud long enough, it'll start looking like Simba from Lion King. It'll start looking like people you know, right? That's because your brain creates patterns where there are none. But at the same time, sometimes it's hard for us to see patterns where there are patterns if there's too much data. And that's the promise of AI and machine learning, is that it can find patterns better than we can. And it can handle massive amounts of data better than a human being can. So we use AI and machine learning for a lot of that, for pattern recognition, particularly when we're trying to find factors that are important for disease transmission, right? So let me give you an example. Do you know what zoonotic diseases are?
No.
Zoonotic diseases are diseases that affect animals and humans, right? Influenza is probably the most famous one, right? The flu. The flu infects pigs, infects birds, infects many mammals, and then it comes to us, right? You probably heard of the swine flu before, bird flu, right? It's one of those diseases that jumps back and forth, right? And there are many diseases like that. Ebola, for example, you heard of Ebola. Ebola is a horrible disease with very high mortality rate, and it's believed that its natural reservoir are bats. So this is a disease that affects bats, but jumps to humans. HIV AIDS is a zoonotic disease because it originally infected chimpanzees and apes in Africa. And then somehow it made the jump to humans in the 1920s. Tuberculosis is one because it came from cattle, cowpox, etc. So zoonotic diseases are diseases that affect animals and humans. Zoonotic diseases are very interesting to know because they have great potential to become very dangerous global pandemics. The most famous one that we're dealing with right now is COVID-19. COVID-19 is a zoonotic disease, right? We believe that it was in a bat and then it made the jump from bats to humans in a Wuhan wet market. So there's a lot of interest right now in looking at zoonotic diseases because that is where the next COVID-19 pandemic is going to come from. You know, and there's a lot of fear that it's going to be something worse than COVID-19. COVID-19, even at as deadly as it was actually not a very, and it was not actually a very serious disease. Its mortality rate, I think its untreated mortality rate was less than 10%. But something like Ebola, which is untreated mortality rate is subject to 60 to 90%. Think about that. That would be nightmarish. You know, instead of 20 million dead, we'd be looking at 1 billion people dead. So there's a worry that some of these diseases, with very high mortality rate, like Lassa fever, Marburg, Ebola, Nipah virus, Congo Crimean fever, all these diseases that have very high mortality rates, that they could make the jump from animals to humans, and they create another global pandemic like the COVID-19 pandemic. So everybody's thinking, how can we prevent this? So one of the things about zoonotic disease is that the risk factors that cause a particular region to be very high risk, they're very geographical in nature, right? The factors that increase the risk are very geographical. For example, one of the main factors is human encroachment into previously wild areas. And basically what that means is that there was a spot of earth that was a jungle, full of the biodiversity that you associate with jungles, right? Monkeys, bats, insects, all kinds of animals. For whatever reason, human beings cut down that jungle so they could move into that either to live or most common for agricultural purposes, right? They want to plant things to eat or to sell. But when they do that, those animals don't go anywhere. They're still living among there. So the risk of a human encountering a wild animal so that it can, that disease can go back and forth goes up very high, right? Mm-hmm. So in these areas of deforestation and new human habitation, that's where the risk for zoonotic spillover, which is that term that we use for a disease jumping from an animal to a human, that's where the risk is the highest. And that's just one of the factors. There are many other factors, right? But once you look at, once you look through all these factors, you're like, these factors are very geographical. They're very social. They're environmental. We can map them. And if you can map it, then you can identify the hot spots on the planet Earth, right? Mm-hmm. You can identify where the risk is the highest. Because again, it goes back to strategic allocation of resources, right? Most countries in the global South, they just don't have the staff, the bandwidth, the budgets to have very extensive disease surveillance like we have in the United States. And so what? How do you help them? If you can identify the places where they need to concentrate on, they can do that, right? Like I told you, they if they have 20 provinces, they probably don't have the money to do disease surveillance in 20 provinces. But if you can pinpoint the 4 provinces where the risk is the highest, they can do that. And that way, we can catch these zoonotic diseases before they become regional outbreaks and maybe global outbreaks. Just by using geography, GIS, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the so that's one of the things that we do, right? We're mapping it out. But it was very important for us to be like, are we missing any patterns? Because we're only humans. We identified about 28 different factors, geographical, social, and environmental, that lend itself to high risk of zoonotic spillover. But we wanted to know more. We wanted to make sure it was exhausted. So that's one of the things we did with machine learning. We downloaded, one of our very talented data scientists and data analysts in my team, they were able to get 50 or 60 years worth of outbreak data from a variety of sources, particularly the World Health Organization, but also the World Bank, Statista, Gideon, a lot of other databases. They were able to pull all that data, 50 years worth of pandemic, something like 440 different outbreaks. And they were able to, with machine learning and AI, literally go through it and say, what patterns can you see when you look at 440 outbreaks? Now, my team could possibly do this, but it would take 3-4 years for them to sit down and go through each outbreak and find out what patterns there are. But with machine learning and artificial intelligence, they were able to do that in a couple months. They were able to go through 400 plus outbreaks and give us a lot of data on what happened in those outbreaks, including patterns that we would not have found on our own. And we incorporated that into our model, into our analytical dashboard to make it even more powerful. Does that make sense?
So what is the future that you see GeoAI will have in the medical industry?
Well, when we talk about that, we have to differentiate between medical and public health, right?
Okay.
So GeoAI, artificial intelligence with geospatial analytics, they will affect both those fields, but subtly different, right? Because medicine, you're more interested in better care of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
In public health, you're more interested in better care of populations, right? So for medicine, for example, GeoAI is going to become very important to map out risk, to look at patterns that human beings can't find, right? So if you're a hospital, let's say you have the Jasmine Memorial Hospital, right? And your catchment area is 50 counties. Where are you from, California?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Let's say in Atlanta, Georgia, your hospital has 50 counties of people that come to your hospital, right? And you want to do better as a hospital. So, you know, you can use geographic information systems, and hospitals do this, to look at that 50 county area and say, what are the patterns of disease? You know, is it evenly distributed or not? And most of the time it isn't, right? Mm-hmm. So you would find patches. You're like, oh, okay. These 11 counties right here have very high rates of diabetes. These 14 counties creating a crescent to the south, they have a really high rate of readmission risk. These 4 counties right here, they're responsible for 90% of our drug overdoses. So all of a sudden, GIS allows you to see all those patterns. And when you see those patterns, you can do interventions, right? If you identify 4 counties that are responsible for 90% of your overdoses, all of a sudden, intervention is possible, right? Because mm-hmm. before, you wouldn't be able to see that pattern if you not do a geographical analysis. But all of a sudden, now you know, So now you can go into that community. You can find community groups. You can create partnerships. You can concentrate your advertisement, your health education on that area. Maybe you have a Narcan, you can pair up with the public health department for a Narcan distribution campaign on those four counties. So for hospitals, that's going to become very, very important, finding that risk for their patients, right? And I think the holy grail is that when a patient comes into a primary care provider, you know, and they fire up that medical record, that GeoAI will have analyzed where that patient lives, what neighborhood, what zip code, and will be able to tell the clinician from the get-go all these different risks. They'll be able to say, hey, this patient comes from an area with very bad air quality. Hey, this patient comes from an area with very high risk of readmission. This patient comes from an area that we calculated has a high risk of opioid abuse. So all those things are information that you as a clinician can use for better care. And it's the same thing for public health, right? Public health is all about finding patterns, you know, clusters, and for primarily for preventive care. So for both of those things, artificial intelligence and machine learning is going to help them immensely go through a lot of data, millions, billions of data points of data that a human being could not, to find those patterns to help better care. Does that make sense?
Yes, and especially for care deserts as well. I could see that being beneficial for areas like that. Like you had just said, people who don't have access to healthcare. I think that pattern would be very beneficial.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is a negative or something that you see is a detriment in the public healthcare industry?
In public health?
Yes.
In the United States?
Mm-hmm. Or even globally.
What's that?
Or even globally, if you want to talk global.
Well, the main thing that hobbles public health is lack of resources.
Mm-hmm.
Public health does not get the respect it needs. Even though it's enormously popular to save lives, it gets something like less than 5% of budgets, right? People just don't respect it because it's because it's a paradox, right? When public health works well, when it's efficient, it's invisible, right? Because it prevents problems. So you never see the problem, right? So you don't know that your community was at risk of a measles outbreak because the public health department found the index patients and were able to isolate them and do contact tracing so that it didn't spread. Your child didn't get measles because they did this, you know, four neighborhoods over. You never knew about it. So there's not a lot of fanfare. When public health is successful, it's invisible. Problems don't happen. As opposed to, say, surgery or medicine, where it's very visible what they do, right? It's very clear that they save lives. So they get all this attention. They get all this budget money. So that's the main issue facing public health today. Number one is that it's just not respected. People just don't think of public health as a vital service. So you see that, you know, public health, local and state public health departments are notoriously chronically underfunded. They just don't get the money that they need. Remember I told you that, like, you know, you want to vaccinate 33 health districts, but you go to your budget person, they say you can vaccinate 10. That's real. I've experienced that. I've seen that happen. That's because they never have enough money. That's where GIS becomes so important, because you need that strategic allocation of resources. If they had enough money, they wouldn't need to find out where they need to concentrate on. So that's the resources are just not there. And public health professionals, very well trained, very talented, they're having a hard time finding jobs because the public health departments just can't hire them. They don't have the money, you know, at the federal level. As you know, there's several agencies that work with public health in the federal level. It's the same thing. They are notoriously underfunded and they are just finding it very hard to hire people. So that's the number one challenge, I think, facing public health right now. And that's globally too, right? The number two challenge is now that public health has also become very politicized. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden, people never thought about public health, but all of a sudden, the COVID-19 pandemic came in and all these conspiracy theories came out of the fringe and became mainstream. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden, public health professionals that before had never encountered this much hostility, they're being attacked. People are calling them liars. People are saying that you want to put a mask on my child? Why? Who are you working for? You know, like all these like very unhinged conspiracy theories, and it became very real, right? In the last 3 years, I've known for a fact multiple health departments, people have quit because of death threats. because of violent threats, because of pressure. You know, I know I met a public health professional who was forced to move because they picketed her house and she has young children, you know, and these people were holding up horrible signs in front of her yard every day when she tried to go to work. And this is just a meek grandma who has spent her entire life just doing her job quietly. All of a sudden she's, you know, she's just, I had to leave. So that's like the second challenge right now. And I don't think it's going to get any better. I think, unfortunately, the conspiracy theory culture that kind of exploded in the United States in 2020, I feel like it's here to stay. You know, there's a lot of skepticism, among a lot of people. And it's going to affect a lot of public health work going into the future.
So I'm wondering, what do you see someone being successful in the public health industry, or if they wanted to get into those industry, but particularly for geospatial analytics, stuff like that, what do you think they would need to do to be successful?
In the individual level or the systemic level?
Let's just do both for fun.
Well, the individual level is hard, right? Because in a way, GIS is still very new, even though we've been using GIS for 100 years, right? If you look at some of the... Have you ever heard of the ghost map?
Yes.
John Snow is the father of epidemiology because that's what happened. You know, in Victorian England in the 1840s, 1850s, I don't remember the exact time, there was a horrible cholera outbreak. And cholera is a horrible disease, right? That thankfully has been mostly controlled in the West. You know, if you get cholera, you can have very watery diarrhea that can basically leach you of your moisture in 2 days. You can be dead as an adult, you can be dead in 2 to 3 days. You can be healthy on Monday, get cholera, and be dead on Wednesday. If you're a child or a baby, you can be healthy at 9 a.m., get cholera, and die by midnight. So it's a very, very aggressive disease, right? And it comes from its fecal-oral transmission, right? It comes from drinking contaminated dirty water. So it's very, very common in very crowded places that don't have good sanitation system. Well, but in the 1840s, no one knew that, right? The germ theory wasn't discovered yet. No one knew what bacteria and viruses were. So no one knew what spread cholera. So there was a horrible cholera outbreak in Victoria, London. And John Snow, who was a doctor at the time, was called to help, you know? He didn't know how to approach this. So what he did was he decided to be analytical about it. He decided to put up to see if he could find a pattern. And he turned to a map, which is, you know, in the end, you could call him also the father of GIS health, of geospatial health. Because he put on a map and he put dots for every single known case of cholera. And what he found was a pattern that was concentrated on one particular street. And he was like, why are there so many more cases here? So he goes there, excuse me, and he sees that they all get water from one pump. So he thought to himself, that pump must be the problem. It's the only thing that would explain it. So he broke the pump handle so people couldn't get water from it anymore. And the cholera cases plummeted. So that was the very first time, you know, GIS was used for health. So what I'm saying is that GIS, even though it's old, it's also new as a discipline, right? And that, and also individually, it's hard for, if an individual wants to become better at GIS, they kind of have to do a lot of work themselves, yeah. You know, because it's not something that's very popular in high schools and colleges. You know, people don't come up and say, you should consider a career in GIS. It's something you have to kind of discover accidentally almost. Every GIS technician, other geospatial engineers at my company, when you asked them, it was the same thing. They were studying something else and they were exposed to GIS and that sparked their interest. So I think it's as an individual, that's the bad part of it is you almost have to stumble upon it accidentally. And so my thinking is that if you do stumble upon it, pursue it. I think it's a really, really important skill set for both clinicians and public health professionals to have. And I hope that that things become more standardized as we go forward, right? With the degrees, because you have a variety of different degrees. You have master's degrees in spatial analysis. You have master's degrees in geospatial analytical system. You have just certificates, different certificates have different weights. You never know which one is respected or not. So I'm really hoping that to facilitate individual choices to pursue a GIS career and knowledge, that more standardization comes to the field, right? So that people know exactly, like if you want to be a doctor in the United States, you know exactly what you need to do. You need to go to an undergrad. You need to apply for medical school. You need to take a test called the MCAT. And then if you get accepted to medical school, you go for medical school for 4 years. At the end of it, you're a medical doctor. And then you do a residency so you can be board certified in the spec. We know the pathway. It's very clear. The pathway for a GIS career is not as clear, I think. And I'm hoping that it becomes more clear. And systemic is very related to that. I hope that schools become more and more, that they propagate the idea that this exists. And it's a very useful thing to go into, right? And it's going to become more useful. And speaking from my own experience, I want schools of medicine and schools of public health and also schools of nursing, anything that's clinical. I want them to bring this up, to introduce students to GIS systems in health. You know, maybe have a class for every public health student. You know, the Masters of Public Health program is 42 credits. Surely we can spare 2 or 3 credits for geospatial, you know, a GIS analytics. Same thing for medicine. Because I think that exposure alone will bring a lot of clinicians into the field to the improvement of the whole field, I think, you know?
Absolutely. Well, John, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure.
Was there anything else you want to leave off with before we head out?
No, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Thank you for letting me preach the evangelism of GIS health, of geospatial health. I'm proud of you and I'm congratulating you and I'm thankful for you for also doing that part, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, guys, thank you so much for listening. This was another episode and we are going to catch you guys on the next one. Bye.